I invite you to take your Bibles and open to Hebrews, the 11th chapter. Hebrews chapter 11, we began this morning at verse 23, basically. I'll talk primarily about verses 24 and 25, but we're going to be looking at this text once again as we deal with the subject of choices are made by assessed values. And what we mean by that is you may choose to purchase something or to keep something in your life that I may see as worthless. But because you value it, it really doesn't matter. It may be a family heirloom. It may be something that has sentimental value to you. You may take it on Antiques Roadshow and they say, this thing's worth $20,000. And I say, sell it. But you don't know. This is too precious. I will never let go of it. And because you value it so much, you're going to make your choices based on your system of values. Now, sometimes our values are accurate. It's not just what we perceive, but what we perceive is accurate and true. If you value your soul above all things in the world, it's not just your perception, it is reality. Your soul is more precious than all the things in the world. And as we started talking in Hebrews, the 11th chapter, at verse 23, we read, by faith Moses, when he was born, was hid 3 months of his parents, because they saw he was a proper child, and they were not afraid of the king's commandment. We talked this morning, by faith, Moses, verse 24, when he was come to years, refused to be called the son of Pharaoh's daughter, choosing rather to suffer affliction with the people of God than to enjoy the pleasures of sin for a season. Moses made a choice. He assessed the value of being an Egyptian, of being in the royal family, of being Pharaoh's daughter, or being afflicted with the people of God, and suffering with them, and being identified with them, and he chose the latter. That is where I need to be. He refused the Egyptians and chose the Israelites because they were the people of God. He refused the physical and chose the spiritual, if you will. And with that thought in mind, we'd like to talk a little bit about why he made that choice. Continuing on then, Hebrews 11 and verse 26, it says, esteeming the reproach of Christ greater riches than the treasures of in Egypt, for he had respect unto the recompense of the reward. That term, esteeming, is what we're talking about. Valuing something. He evaluated it and determined this has more worth than that. The reproach of Christ, he determined, was of greater value than all the treasures of Egypt. Now, the word reproach means an insult or humiliating treatment. So I would rather be humiliated and ridiculed with Christ than to be sitting on top of the world without Him. It's the idea that I would rather be a street sweeper in heaven than the king of all of hell. And I'll tell you what, you better hope that. And we talk sometimes about, are there degrees of in hell or punishment, degrees of joy in heaven? Well, I don't know if there is or isn't, but I'll tell you what, the lowest spot in heaven is better than the highest spot in hell. And you better want to be there and devote yourself to getting there. And so he esteemed the reproach of Christ to be identified with God's people as greater riches than all the treasures in Egypt. For he had respect until the recompense of the reward. Simply put, he recognized this reward as real. And that is the problem that we have. Sometimes we just do not evaluate heaven as real as it is. And we think, well, what I see in front of me and what I can smell and what I can touch and what I can taste and what can be proved by the scientific method, those are the things that are real. No, God is real. Heaven is real. Eternal life is real. Eternal punishment is real. And it better become real enough in our mind that we will make our decisions based on that truth. Now, you may wonder where Moses got his system of values. We're not told exactly where he got that. The assumption is that his mother, and maybe you're familiar with the story, I suspect you are, when Moses was born as a baby, his mother was supposed to drown him in the river because he was a boy. But she didn't. She hid him for 3 months. And then when he got too big, I suppose, to keep hidden, she put him in the river, but she didn't put him in a river to drown. She put him in a basket inside the river and sent him floating down the river. Was discovered by Pharaoh's daughter, and Pharaoh's daughter decided to keep him, even though she recognized he was a Hebrew baby, and to raise her as her own. Well, as she's looking this baby over, Miriam, Moses' older sister, comes to her and said, would you like me to get you a Hebrew woman to nurse the baby? And she said, yes, that'd be a good idea. And so she went and got Moses' mother. And so Moses' mother, not only did she keep the baby alive, but she was being paid by Pharaoh to keep the baby alive. And so it all worked out according to the providence of God. But that is the way in which Moses came about to be kept alive and was in the process of being in a position to deliver the children of Israel. In verse 23 then, as we see the behavior of the parents, it says by faith Moses, and I think this should really be the faith of his parents because he's a baby not making these decisions, when he was born, was hid 3 months of his parents because they saw he was a proper child and they were not afraid of the king's commandment. These parents had faith. They looked past the here and now. The here and now is the king's threat. If you have a baby boy, you kill him. If you don't, you're in real trouble. Well, that's what's here right now. But when they saw the baby and they recognized that he was proper, they determined that they were going to keep him. Now, keeping him was threatening Amram and Jochebed, the parents. It was threatening Aaron and Miriam, the older siblings. They could have all been killed because they disobeyed the command, but they disregarded the command, were not afraid of the command. When they saw that he was a proper child, and I can't biblically prove it by any means, but the idea of seeing him as a proper child just suggests to me that there's something more than thinking, well, he's a cute baby. You know, have you ever seen a parent that had a baby and said, well, he's not really that cute? I don't think so. When parents look at their baby, oh yeah, he's a good baby. But I think there must be something more than that in the seeing of Moses. And I think maybe they were looking past the here and now of the king's commandment to execute the baby to the then and there of maybe this is the baby that's going to eventually deliver us from bondage of the Egyptians. Something was seen in this child. Now, Hebrews simply says that they saw he was a proper child. But look at Exodus chapter 2, verse 2 for just a moment. In Exodus 2 and verse 2, says, and the woman conceived and bare a son, in which she saw him, that he was a goodly child. She hid him 3 months. And so she observed him that he was a goodly child. Now there was something special about him, something significant. And then in verse 6, when Pharaoh's daughter pulls him out of the water, it says, when she had opened it, that's the basket, she saw the child, and behold, the babe wept, and she had compassion on him and said, this is one of the Hebrews' children. Now, she knew the command that they were supposed to be executed, but as she looked upon him, she had compassion on him. Why? Why was she willing to violate the king's command? Well, there's something special about this child. There's something significant in him. Look at Acts the 7th chapter for just a moment. In Acts chapter 7, again, this is Stephen making his defense before the Jews and going through Old Testament history as he does so. In Acts chapter 7, verse 20 says, in which time Moses was born and was exceeding fair and nourished up in his father's house 3 months. There may have been something about this baby that just gave everybody the idea that this is a child that really ought to be spared, that ought to be kept alive. He's going to be some great one in his day. I don't know if that's something we could approved beyond any shadow of doubt or not, but it seems to me that's the way people were thinking in regard to this, that they really wanted to risk all to protect him. And everyone that came across this baby had that feeling. Well, then in verse 27 of Hebrews 11, it says, by faith, he, that's Moses, forsook Egypt, not fearing the wrath of the king, for he endured as seeing him who is invisible. You know, kind of gives you a little bit of a chuckle when you think about it, that here this Pharaoh has given his order, every baby that's born a male is supposed to be executed, thrown into the river. And Moses' parents disobeyed that. They weren't afraid of the king. Pharaoh's daughter disobeyed that. She wasn't afraid of the king. Right here it says Moses was not afraid of the king. And I don't know if this guy was not really very good at putting terror into his subjects or not, or whether these people just recognize that there is a spiritual hierarchy that's more important than what this man has to offer. So by faith he forsook Egypt, not fearing the wrath of the king, for he endured. And when I think of that enduring, I don't know what comes to your mind, but I think of the time that he fled from Egypt. And while he was fleeing from it and going through the desert and finding his way to the Midian encampment where he became a shepherd and the Mount Sinai and so on, it must have been a pretty treacherous and involved journey. And he kept on going and kept on doing and worked as the shepherd and was faithful to God all the way through this because he saw God as something that was real. He saw the invisible God as if God was visible and in front of him. That real to him was God. And that's how he endured. That's how he kept on going. Now it says he forsook. The word forsook literally means to leave down. A compound word. And I don't know what you envision in your mind, but that there's times that I'll be working on something and I'll get tired and I'll be getting exhausted and then I'll drop something. And when I drop it, I go, it's staying there. Well, that's where what it means. Leave down. I'm not going to bend over and pick that up. And so the idea is to leave something behind, to abandon something. It's the word that is used in 2 Peter. And here it's talking about something that should not be left behind. It's talking about the sinful people and how they leave behind the right way. 2 Peter 2 verse 15 says, which have forsaken, there's our word, the right way and are gone astray following the way of Balaam the son of Beor, who loved the wages of unrighteousness. These are people who are willing to leave down, to leave behind, to abandon the right way as they pursue the example of covetous individuals going after rewards. It's interesting that in Matthew, the 19th chapter, and verse 5, we have the same word that's translated forsook here. There is translated leave when it talks about we leave father and mother and cleave to our wife. You recall this morning we talked about most decisions usually involve two things. And you're going to have to either cleave to your parents or cleave to your spouse, one or the other. And the right way to do it is to leave father and mother and cleave to your spouse. If you're not ready to cleave to your spouse and to leave your parents, you're not ready to get married yet. And you stay with your parents until you grow up, and then you can leave father and mother and cleave to your wife. And this isn't talking about disrespecting our parents or neglecting them or anything like that, but that you leave them behind as you recognize a new house is being set up as you enter into the marriage relationship. We're told that he endured as if he's seen that which was invisible, him that is invisible. There are three passages in the Bible that refer that use the word invisible. This is the King James version of the New Testament. Three passages in the New Testament that use the word invisible, all talking about God. In 1 Timothy 1, verse 17, it refers to him. And in Colossians 1, verse 15, if you want to turn there real quickly. And of course, the Hebrew one is the other one what we're referring to. But Hebrews, Colossians 1, 15 says, who is the image of the invisible God, speaking of Jesus? Jesus is the image of the invisible God, the firstborn of every creature. And so God was invisible, and Moses pursued him as he was real, as he saw him. 1 Timothy 1 verse 17 refers to the invisible God, and Colossians 1 verse 15 refers to the invisible God. The word invisible is also used in verse 16 of Colossians 1, there referring to created things. It says, for by him were all things created that are in heaven and that are on earth, visible and invisible. Whether they be thrones or dominions or principalities or powers, all things were created by him and for him. Do you realize there are created things that are invisible? Well, sure there are. Now, if you were to go back in Bible days, they could be talking about microscopic things. You and I can see them through our technology today, but to them, that was invisible. They could not see the germs, and they could not see the DNA, and they could not see all of the various things that we're capable of seeing through our technology. There were things that were too far away from them they could not see. They didn't have the massive Hubble telescopes to see solar systems and planets and stars that are billions of miles away from us. They couldn't see those things. To them, they were invisible. But God created other things that also are actually 100% invisible. Things like your soul. You can't see it. You can't see the spirit. When someone dies and the spirit leaves them, you don't say, oh, there it goes. You can't see that. That spirit is invisible. We can talk about our imagination. It's invisible. Our mind is invisible. Our brain is visible, but not our mind. Our ideas are invisible. The wind is invisible. And on we can go with a list of things that can't be seen. And yet they are real, and they were created by God. And then there are traits of God that are invisible as well. Romans 1, verse 20. It says, for the invisible things of him from the creation of the world are clearly seen, being understood by the things that are made, even his eternal power and Godhead, so that they are without excuse. You can't actually see the power of God. You can see what the power of God has done. You can see the things that He has created. You can see the things that He has declared. But you understand the goodness of God by what it is you observe in the physical world round about you. And you learn about His fairness and His righteousness and His goodness and His power and so on by the things that we see. But those traits are invisible, just like God Himself is invisible. But to Moses, they were very real, very visible, very concrete in his mind. And so they should be in ours as well. Continuing on then, Hebrews 11, verse 28. We read, through faith He kept the Passover and the sprinkling of the blood, lest He that destroyed the firstborn should touch them. You will recall at the first Passover, they were instructed to take the blood of the lamb, put it on the lintel and on the doorpost, and if they did that, then when the destroyer came through, he would pass over their house, is where the name comes from, and not destroy the firstborn that was in it. They had to have faith in God in order to do that. I don't see why that blood's going to make any difference. You know, God made distinction between the Israelites and the Egyptians in a bunch of the other plagues that He sent. Why didn't He just do it again and instead of doing this blood thing? Because God commanded it. And they had to do it in order to be spared. And Moses had the faith to do what it was God said. By faith, they passed through the Red Sea as by dry land, which the Egyptians, as saying to do, were drowned. And so the applied blood showed that they believed in the destroyer. That He was going to come and He was going to destroy all the firstborn in Egypt, and He would destroy the firstborn in Israel as well if the blood was not applied in obedience to His word. They had to believe. And you know, it seems like it would be an easy thing to believe in God at that point. We've had 9 plagues already, you know. This 10th one coming says, yeah, whatever you say, God, I believe you can do it. You would think they'd have a great deal of confidence in what He's capable of doing by that point. But, you know, when they get to the Red Sea, they're complaining to Moses again. We're going to be destroyed by the Egyptians. We don't know what to do. What's going to happen to us? Having no idea that the same God that delivered them from Egypt can deliver them all the way to the promised land. And so we have the parting of the Red Sea. They cross upon it. The Egyptians try to do the same thing and are destroyed. And so what we see then is the power of the invisible God overcame the mighty Egyptians. And that Moses' values were proper. What he assessed as really being worthwhile and choosing to go after that thing was the right way to go. Because God is real. And it's the right thing for us to do, to follow God and to follow His word and to not be hung up with all the physical things of the world that kind of weigh us down. And so in conclusion, we might ask ourselves the question, how real is God to us? Think about that for just a moment. How real is God to us? Is He stronger than our federal government? You know, people are awful bent out of shape about what our government's doing. Oh, the wrong person got elected. Oh, they're increasing taxes again. Oh, they may take away our nonprofit status. Oh, they're going to persecute us with hate crimes if we preach against homosexuality. And on the process goes. And these things may really happen to us. But is God stronger than our federal government? And the answer is yes. And so don't worry about what the government does. Keep on being faithful to God. Is God stronger than the nation of Islam? Well, the answer again is yes. And a lot of us are concerned about the Islam, what they're going to do, because it seems that they're bent on destroying everybody who's not part of their religion. And if they continue to grow in popularity and grow in power and elect officials and control nations, what are they going to do to all of us that are Christians? Well, it doesn't matter. God is stronger than they are. That doesn't mean He's going to physically deliver us, but it means we're going to be going to heaven when we die. And so don't be concerned about that. Our God is stronger than the nation of Islam. Our God is stronger than our federal government. Is He more valuable than comfort? Think about that. So, oh, I love God, but I'm not going to get out of bed on Sunday morning to make it a Bible class. I mean, my bed is so comfortable. It's so cold outside, and I'll get a chill if I go out, so I'm not going to go to worship service today. Is God more valuable to you than comfort? Is God more valuable to you than wealth? Well, I would come to services, but you know, I can work overtime, and I get paid double on Sundays when I do that, you know, and so I'm going to be doing that. Is God more valuable to you than wealth? How do you assess Him? Is God more valuable to you than being popular among your friends? Well, I don't want to say anything about being a Christian or going to church because all my friends will laugh at me. And I don't want that to happen. I'd be so embarrassed, you know, if they knew I was a religious person. So I just kind of keep that quiet. Is God more valuable to you than family? If your family chooses to go into sin, are you going to go right along with them? Or are you going to stay faithful to the Lord? How do you assess Him? You will make your choices by how well you value God. Is He capable of guiding us through sickness? You know, sometimes we're fine as Christians until we start feeling sick. And then when we start feeling sick, God has deserted me, and we lay in our bed and we moan and we cry and we wonder why God doesn't take this illness away just that quick, you know. We need to be stronger than that and realize that He can guide us through that. He can guide us through our debt. People that get behind on their payments, many times through no fault of your own. And I know it's an anxiety that hangs around and bothers you to think you're in that situation. But He can guide you through that. He can guide you through temptation. That's what we're supposed to pray for. Lead us not into temptation. And He can guide us through death as well. We can die in this physical world and come out the other side in heaven. God has the power to do that if we value Him and trust Him enough to keep on following Him. And finally then, with all of this being true, that with Him being stronger, more valuable, more capable, is He worthy of our worship? Indeed, without a doubt. And why would we ever miss an opportunity to worship Him? Is He worthy of our obedience? Yes. It's an inescapable conclusion. Why, surely He's entitled to our obedience. He created us. He blessed us. He keeps us alive. You know, God provides all the things we need. You know, there are so many things that are going on right now that we don't even think about. And God is maintaining them every minute. What if God just decided for the next 10 minutes, like, I think I'll shut off the oxygen. No more air. And we all start getting our throats and start breathing poorly and collapsing down and so on. And we don't realize that God keeps supplying it all the time. Well, if He created us and maintains us and has a place for us to go afterwards, isn't He entitled to our obedience? Surely He is. And our love as well. For all the love He had for us, the giving of His Son, surely we should love God. If we have the right perspective of God, if we recognize how valuable He is as the Creator, the Sustainer, our Lover, as the person who has given us all the things we need to live well in this life and to go to heaven, if we recognize all that about God, then the choices we make will not be ones to go into sin. Will not be one to follow the pleasures of sin for a season, as we talked about this morning, or to seek the treasures that can be obtained in this world when they're spiritual riches that we ought to be looking for. If you're here this evening and you're not a Christian, I hope there's been something said that might cause you to rethink your decision, that you've not yet submitted to the will of God. You've not yet started following Him. But you realize that He has so many precious gifts for you. All the things that you enjoy in this physical life, that's just a smidge, a sampling of what He has. The real treasures are the ones in the spiritual life. When you get in a right relationship with God, when you have the peace that passes understanding, when you have the promise of heaven, when you've got the forgiveness of sins, when you've got brothers and sisters in Christ, and eventually, when you have heaven. That is what the real values are. And I hope you will appreciate that. If you've never become a Christian, you need to hear, believe, repent, confess, and be baptized. That can be done this very evening. The waters of baptism are prepared. We have garments for you to put on. More than happy to assist you, but you need to come forward and make your request known. If we can assist you in any way, come right now while we stand, while we sing.